Great. Oh, well, let's...
Oh, we're already starting, huh?
Yeah, this this interrupted our planning session for the show by the show starting.
Fauci. We got to get it out there that that's what we're talking about, because we are blowing the lid off this thing right now.
On Fauci, my freed up. That's what I have to say.
Exactly.
Actually, we're extra Fauciing it. We got an extra dose of Fauci.
Man, that craven character. So he was back in the news this week. Senator Rand Paul grilled him before his committee. Fauci, it was funny. I was watching an interview with Deborah Birx. You remember her on News Nation right before I was on News Nation. And she was saying... She was a little critical of him. She was saying, I hope that he's just humble and tells the truth and knows people want to get answers. Didn't take that advice. He took the advice of counsel, which is what he should do.
Yeah.
And he pleaded the fifth. Although there's that argument that this is a rare circumstance. You should always plead the fifth. You should never, ever, ever, ever say anything real. It's just the nature of how criminal prosecutions work. Anything you say can and will be used against you, etc. He is in...
Not in a court of law.
He's in the one position where... He got a pretty blanket pardon that is very ironclad. If there's one circumstance where it maybe is unnecessary, I mean, I get from his perspective, like, well, why participate with you people? But this is an argument, and Rand made this argument after that, well, like he's in the one circumstance where you maybe plausibly don't need to plead the fifth because we cannot prosecute you.
So I don't know if I entirely agree with that.
I'm not saying I entirely agree with that either. I'm just putting it out there.
Well, so just firstly,
many people are saying.
Firstly, from a perspective of a public official or former public official who wants to do right by the country and the public, you should answer serious, legitimate questions about your role in government and what effect you might have had on this giant global cataclysm known as the COVID-19 pandemic. So, from that perspective alone, he should have answered Rand's questions. But where I disagree with, Josh Hawley made kind of the dumber case of this.
He made the dumbest version of it, yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, you don't get any Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination because you've already received a pardon. As Fauci said in his opening statement, though, his concern is that he would say something that would then open him up to criminal liability in that hearing, which wouldn't be covered by the pardon, right? So, you know, if he lied, or at least, you know, his assertion is that we're going to twist his words into saying that he lied.
Well, there's state liability, there's civil liability, categories that are not covered by the pardon.
Yeah, so I watched, I've been following, you know, the lab leak stuff, COVID origins, for a long time, and I watched the hearing, or at least the first sections of it with him and Rand. I have to say, you know, oftentimes when... In the, you know, you have the main villain dragged before a congressional committee hearing. It's kind of anticlimactic, or maybe the hero as well. Like, I don't know if you remember the Mueller hearings from forever ago, where Democrats bring in Robert Mueller or Mueller or whatever. And it's
Mueller
just
time.
Yeah, it's, you know, and this was like their white knight, their savior.
Brace who was yourself. Mueller is coming.
The walls are closing
Man,
in on
the
Trump.
Memes at that. They
we finally got him. It was.
They worked themselves up into a fervor.
Yeah, he was a proto Fauci. You know, this bureaucrat that is lionized by Democrats as kind of the perfect foil for Trump. But then they bring him in. He produces this report about Russiagate, whatever. They bring him in to ask all these questions, expecting him to basically do the job that they need him to do to give them some excuse to impeach Trump. And it is the most boring possible hearing ever. Deflating is an excellent word for it. Very good. he just, every single question, he's just like, well, I guess you got to read the report. It was so boring. This is actually an exception to this rule. You would think Fauci goes in, pleads the fifth to Rand, was going to ask him specifically and did ask him, you know, didn't get any answers, but asked him specifically about his role funding gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where quite plausibly, I certainly believe, the pandemic started. Pleads the fifth, doesn't answer these questions, but the drama was off the charts.
It was.
Right? You have these two guys, Rand and Fauci, who both have nothing but burning contempt for each other. Yes. And they are kind of like the perfect antagonists for each other. You know, in Fauci's perspective, this, you know, grandstanding rube and conspiracy theorist. From Rand's perspective, this dissembling, lying bureaucrat who, you know, is just going to, you know, do whatever he wants and doesn't really care about public oversight. Yeah, there was just so much tension and drama in the room, and just Rand asking him steady, reasonable, straightforward questions, and Fauci just like looking, in my view, kind of shaken, whether from, I don't know if from, I guess, rage or what, from his diaries being released or whatever, but just like clearly wanting to fly off the handle and not.
Well, those diaries, in my view, are the first kind of significant moving of the needle a little bit we've gotten a while, because I wouldn't say that all of it is interesting, and some of the stuff the media seized upon, okay, he was really full of himself, he liked going on TV, whatever. You can dislike him for that. But there were a couple things in there that were interesting and not, and at least contradicting himself in public to some degree.
No, I think this is
I mean he said he describes that research as gain of function.
Yeah, so this is
that's the thing.
The two most damning things from the diaries in the lead up to this hearing, Rand released Fauci's 1,000-page diary, which was I guess saved on his work computer. I've heard it speculated that it was
dumb idea to do it that way.
Sure. Well, so I've heard it speculated that basically this was kind of like notes for an eventual memoir, right? Because like it's not a diary of like, you know, me and my wife got into a fight today, or you know, where am I going in this world that we you know, this is none of that, right? It's literally all his day to day running the NIH.
Me and my
during
Asian
panic.
Husband got into a fight today.
That would have been a revelation. it's his day to day running NIAID during the COVID-19 pandemic, right. And then his very detailed list of media appearances that he did. What I found most substantive and most interesting was two things from the diary. The first was, and we had already known this from some other emails, so there wasn't like a lot of significant revelations, but there is now pretty solid proof that he just lied to Congress.
Yes. And he said it wasn't gain of function, but in his diary he said it's gain of function. That's the research the Bat Lady is doing, that the 10 of the 12 scientists he's on this call with say are alarmed because they know we funded gain of function for her to do exactly this research that looks like this, and they're alarmed.
So to back up a little for listeners, gain of function research is this branch of research where you manipulate viruses in a lab to make them more virulent, right? And the speculated benefits, although it's a doubtful benefit, is that you can then use this to produce vaccines and therapeutics, spot the next pandemic, right?
And Fauci is the number one person associated with the need to do that research and in favor of
doing
it.
Been the primary advocate for the U.S. government funding this research.
He's the guy.
Yes.
Who makes that case.
At the very beginning of the pandemic, in January, he gets a call from two scientists who say, hey, we've been looking at this virus, and it looks like it's been engineered. It looks like someone inserted a fern cleavage site on the spike protein, which allows it to, you know, bind with human lung cells and spread and kill all of us, right? So he gets this call. He takes it seriously enough, and in fact, in his diary, he distinguishes, he's like, there's all these conspiracy theories about how COVID has bits of AIDS inserted into it or whatever else, or HIV. He's like, those are crazy, but this actually sounds really serious. So the next day, he convenes a panel convenes a conference call with, 12 experts, right, where 10 out of the 12 say, we think this is engineered, and Fauci kind of summarizing why they think that, but not critically, noting it, says, yes, they've been doing gain of function in Wuhan by, you know, putting spike proteins on these coronaviruses. And then he mentions two people on the call disagree with this. And he's like, yeah, but they would say that because they've been doing gain of function research. So it's like, OK, so you're going to take.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fast forward to 2021, there was a series of hearings where he spoke with Rand Paul, and Rand Paul pressed him on this very type of research that had been published, saying, this is gain of function research. There was there was government restrictions on this research at the time. Your agency funded this research. And he says, no, flat out, we never funded gain of function research at Wuhan. That's not true. This research never could have caused a pandemic.
Right.
And so what the diaries show is that he, you know, he's since
gone on. He described it that way.
He described it that way. Not only did he describe it that way, he accepted that this research could well have resulted in a virus that caused the pandemic, this right. very specific type right. of research. So, you know, he goes on to play all these semantic games about, oh, you know, you can use, there's a generic term for gain of function research. We have a precise federal regulatory definition for gain of function. That's what I mean when I say gain of function. No, no.
Right.
You call this gain of function research. And
that's not what we're interested in anyway.
No, yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Rand was very good in the hearing saying, you know, you can play all these semantic games about whether this qualifies for the federal regulatory definition or not, but like at the end of the day, the question is, was this a good idea?
Yeah.
Was it risky? You know,
and
should we have done
COVID?
That? Yeah. Should we have done that? And clearly, if you thought it could have caused a pandemic at the time, you would have to say that right. no, there was huge risks, right?
Right?
Yeah, so this is very clear proof that he lied about the nature of the research going on there, NIAID's involvement with it. That's pretty damning.
Right.
I will say, I think having followed LabLeak for a long time, there was maybe this assumption out there that Fauci knows exactly what happened in Wuhan and is sitting on a bunch of the evidence, even if it's just in his own head and is refusing to say, you know, that evidence and just come clean. I don't think that's not the case.
That's not the case.
And in fact, if you look at his later diary entries, he himself, just in his own diaries, is saying, you know, he reverts to, you know, once he's getting public scrutiny from, you know, conservative politicians, he's like, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. They hate me because I represent the truth.
Right.
This is part of a wider plot against the Republic. The guy's narcissism is off the charts. So I think he has convinced himself that, you know, the pandemic's of natural origin, whatever else.
I don't understand the level of, we don't know for sure. There are some reasons why it's one or the other. The intelligence agencies and the experts disagree. There are some that favor one explanation and some that favor the other. That's all fine. And you can have your private hunches or what evidence you weigh more, but you just can't take the position that it's settled and we know it was animal spillover, which is the position that I'm baffled to still see a lot of liberals and Democrats take. Destiny, the YouTube streamer, who's like a very moderate liberal, actually. He has feuds with a lot of progressives. He tweeted something like that's animal spillover. It's a conspiracy theory if you disagree. Mehdi Hasan seized on that. And then I was actually fighting with Mehdi Hasan the other day about this. Is I'm like, you just can't, the CIA, the FBI, the Energy Department, and the former head of the CDC have all concluded lab leak. And then you can point to other scientific agencies that don't agree. But you can't say that there's no, like, I would like to know what the CIA and FBI have based their assessment on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't know.
There is, in fact, a law saying they have to disclose what they know.
They didn't.
Yeah.
They disclosed a summary of what we already know.
Right.
But, like, it's if there is smoking gun evidence, the people who have it are, I assume, the CIA. And that kind of evidence that would, it's kind of funny, we'd be like, we'll never know. I'm like, maybe we'll never know. But also, if the CIA is, for instance, in possession of intelligence that people were sick at the Wuhan Institute of Virology with COVID prior to the wet market, then we would know for sure. I don't know that they have that evidence. That could, the Wall Street Journal has reported something to that effect at one point. Maybe they might, could be inaccurate. I would like to be able to weigh that evidence for myself, which is why this stuff should be disclosed. But like there is knowledge that could be held by intelligence agencies.
So the metaphor I like to, or I came up with to describe like what we know now and what we maybe never will know is like, imagine you have this big black box, right?
Okay.
And you're imagining it?
I'm picturing it.
Okay.
It's very big and very black.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, yeah.
I like my coffee, like I like my boxes.
Okay, well let's proceed.
Strong and black.
the box is small and transparent. okay, and water is going in one end of the box and ice is coming out the other. That would suggest to you that there is a freezer inside this box, right?
Right.
You don't know exactly the design of the freezer, its size or whatever else, right? But like you can be pretty sure from the information you have about what's going in the box and what's coming out that there's a freezer in there. Similarly, we have overwhelming circumstantial evidence,
right,
and even not even just circumstantial, just like direct evidence that they're doing risky gain-of-function research in Wuhan. A pandemic starts in Wuhan, having all these features of the kinds of research, the virus having all these features of the kinds, yes, of research and manipulation of viruses that they were doing, that we know that they were doing. What we don't know is like the like specific viruses maybe they were manipulating.
Right.
And the play-by-play of like, did someone prick their finger, drop a vial, whatever else. You read reporting about, you know, lab leaks happen.
Yes.
You read.
Well, that's part of the reason it changed my mind when I realized, oh, this does happen. It happened in the Soviet Union. Anthrax breakout,
mm-hmm,
and all the scientists, even Western scientists, all said it's not a lab leak because they don't want scrutiny for their research either.
Right. And so, but you read about, right, if a lab leak happens in a normal free country, there's eventually an investigation and you, yes, do get down to like the day by, you know, act by act details of how the, you know, how the lab leak happened. We're dealing with a lab leak that happened in a communist dictatorship.
Right.
That is dead set on nothing coming out about COVID origins, even if it were a natural origin. You know, the Chinese government's perspective is this is going to look bad for us regardless. And so less people know, the better. We'll say it's, you know, it was actually happened at the CDC lab in Atlanta or whatever else, right? So I don't think we're going to, you know, you can't FOIA the CCP.
I
doubt that we'll ever, you know, unless, you know, their commie bullshit falls apart in 40 years and we get some archival documents, we'll ever literally know those final details. And so what we're left with is just, again, what we can say about the research happening at that lab and what the result was.
The nagging, I agree with everything you're saying, but the nagging doubt I still have, though, about the lab leak explanation is that it's still there's a coincidence either way is the problem. This is an event almost orchestrated by a higher power to divide us, because the initial outbreak is in a wet market with animals, the kinds of which have caught, you know, viruses jumping from animals to humans. The initial outbreak isn't at a movie theater or a sports stadium or a school or a mall, but a place that has animals. So that is a coincidence. Now, it's a coincidence either way, because if you believe it's an animal spillover at this wet market, like, okay, it was at this wet market, the mm-hmm. one that is geographic, like on a large enough scale across the street virtually from the one place they do experiments on bats that would produce a virus that looks exactly like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a hard coincidence to get past if you're accepting the animal spillover theory. If you're expecting the lab leak theory, the hard coincidence is your first place is at a thing with animals rather than, you know.
Yeah.
It's a problem either way, because either theory has to contend with the inconvenience that the thing that explains the other thing is right fucking there.
Yeah. Well, the lab leak pushback on this would be, you know, a first observed cluster is at a wet market. But again, it's a public place with a lot of people interacting, so that's not necessarily surprising.
Right.
And then secondly, they haven't found the animal source
right.
of it, right?
Right.
Which is, you know,
right.
you found it with SARS, you found it with other pandemics.
Which is why I lean toward lab leak.
Right.
But that's a coincidence. You know what best hybridizes the two theories? Somebody takes a bunch of the bats parts, get thrown out in the trash, and some ne'er-do-well, like, you know, I'm gonna sell these at the wet market down the street. I'm gonna make a buck. Just takes them out of the trash, drops them off at the wet market. There you go.
Yum.
Bingo, you're Yum. Saved. Wouldn't it be crazy if it was something like that?
Yeah, so the real problem is composting and recycling.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a menace.
That would save us.
The second thing I found revelatory and substantively scandalous about Fauci's diaries is his comments on lockdowns and his own behind the scenes advising
yes.
of lockdowns. Again, this isn't something that, like, this isn't some huge surprise, but, you know, Fauci has become a hate figure, I think, in large part initially because of the lockdowns, right?
Yes.
And his advocacy for, you know, extreme COVID right. mitigation measures like that, right?
Right?
That's why a lot of conservatives came around to hating him,
right?
Right. And his response to that, which, you know, I at least partly bought that some of the hate on this particular question was overdone, is that he was, like, his official role was that of an advisor, yes, right? The lockdowns are all done at a state and local level. It's those officials who are actually implementing the policy, enforcing the policy. They did it, not him. He has, you know, made this point repeatedly. He's like, hey, you didn't like the lockdowns. I didn't lock down anyone. I didn't close any schools. That's technically true. But you then read in his diaries where he, you know, gets a call from Bill de Blasio. He gets a call from Andrew Cuomo. He is like, shut down the schools.
Shut it all
shut down the bars. Yeah.
Shut it down. Right.
He and gets a call from Gavin Newsom's chief of staff saying, hey, we took your advice.
Yes.
And shut down the state. And so for him then to say, oh, I had nothing to do with this, is complete bullshit.
Well, and I think he even used the language in an interview he did with me. I'd have to play it back again, where he even said, when we interviewed him on Rising, Bacha Unger Sargon and I, and we asked him about maybe regrets he'd had, and she used phrasing, you know, recommending lockdowns or whatever. And I think he pushed back on the idea that he even had recommended them. I'd have to watch it again.
Wow.
But he certainly recommended them. He's in there saying, yeah, Bill de Blasio, Bill de Blasio had decided to shut down the schools of his own volition. Fauci says, now do restaurants, now do bars, now do other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was done at his behest. And while I would understand the point that it's certainly not a crime to offer advice that was bad.
Yeah, sure.
We can't prosecute him for that. So the prosecution about lying to Congress or being culpable for the inciting incident that causes the pandemic.
Violating various restrictions
is a crime, or should be a crime. It's a moral crime. Giving bad advice, okay, I get it. That's not, people are allowed to do that in politics. They're allowed to say, we should regulate this, we should raise your taxes. It's not, I don't want my taxes raised. It's not a crime to suggest that, unfortunately, no. It's fine. But we have to evaluate, like, whether this advice was good when he is the guy. Right. He was the one. He wasn't just the face of it. He was the face of it, and he was the one urging the determinations.
Right.
And he was in favor of militant social distancing, masking, mandating masks, locking down vast industry, you know, all of your in blue states. Well, this many people can be at the restaurant, and this is the certain you wear a mask, and all of that absurdity.
Idiocy. Yeah.
Which we conducted an experiment in, because by the end of the summer, we had gone our own ways and red states had stopped listening to these things and blue states were doing them as much as they could.
Ad nauseum, I believe is the Latin.
And what we know now, and this is like, what could be a bigger indictment of this man than this? The difference in mortality between the states that did everything Fauci wanted and the states that told him to take a hike after the first month is zero.
Yeah.
There is no statistical difference in the mortality outcomes. Differences do set in after the vaccines roll out, and then if you're a red state that was more vaccine hesitant, not because the vaccines were stopping the transmission, but because for elderly and obese people who hadn't yet had COVID,
getting the
vaccine was going to reduce your likelihood of severe disease and death by an appreciable amount.
Yeah.
That's just true. Sorry, anti-vax people, that's true for the at-risk population.
Yeah.
If you'd already had COVID or you're otherwise healthy, it doesn't matter whether you get the vaccine or not.
Yep.
That's just how it is.
Yeah.
If you hadn't had it yet and you're a big person or an old person, you should have gotten that thing.
Yeah.
So there is a difference at that point. But all of that earlier stuff, the lockdowns, the distance, the masks, it came to nothing.
Yeah.
So think about that. When you saw people wrestling masks onto their preschoolers, canceling their preschooler's birthday, or making them stand, you know, drawing a chalk circle around them on the sidewalk so they have to look at their friends from afar. That is Fauci's legacy. And that was all for absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
It makes me furious.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because I think he should have recognized this from the very beginning. And it's an interesting example of how once you're kind of a statist, or you just accept certain political facts about the world, you end up trying to impose that logic on a virus that doesn't care at all. And right. what I mean specifically about this is, at the very beginning of the pandemic, he, which is kind of the public health WHO perspective, he was very critical of travel bans. And he says at one point in his diary, he's like, I've recommended against travel bans because the virus is already here. So what does it matter if, you know, why are we, would we try to police the airports if we're already having community spread? The virus is here, so it doesn't matter if people are coming in from outside the country, right? But that same logic should have suggested to you that this very transmissible virus that's already spreading, it's not going to course, you know, you can understand it when it comes to political borders, but within the country, that also says that, suggests that lockdowns are not going to be effective either, because right. there's going to be, even if everyone stays home from the bars and the restaurants and doesn't send their kids to school, the level of social activity that still needs to happen to keep society going to keep this virus circulating. It doesn't matter if you have, you know, code purple, you have to eat outside, you know, code black, you have to, everyone has to stay inside. The virus is still going to be spreading. You can understand that in the perspective, you know, in the context of airports and international travel. You should understand it in the context of domestic intra-city travel, but he didn't, and a lot of people didn't. And yeah, that's how we went down this path of lockdowns and increasingly absurd
and restrictions. And they were, the initial lockdowns, we sometimes forget, were never sold to the public or to Trump or to governors on the basis of, we need to keep transmission down to stop people from getting sick. It was done for a very specific reason, which is that hospitals need to prepare to get a massive influx of patients, and a lot more people will die than is necessary if hospitals don't have enough beds and ventilators, and they'd have to do triage care. So we need a lockdown for right. this period of time, so our hospitals are ready, and then we're going to let it rip. Because people, it's a contagious disease and there's no stopping it. But there will be many more deaths if we have to ration care because we're not ready. So we're going to just take 2 weeks to be ready. That was the initial logic, which made sense to me. I said, it made sense to everyone. I'm like, okay, that's something, that's yeah. not an unreasonable thing to ask no. in the face of this disease. So we're going to do that. And then they just yanked the football away from us and said, nah, we're going to do this.
Yep.
We're just
they convinced themselves that this yeah. was the one thing that they,
yeah.
that once you start it, they're like, well, we can't just let it go because then the, we can't just stop it because then the cases will go up, deaths will go up, right? Yeah, the argument, the best argument for lockdowns is that there's a difference in, you know, the same number of people are going to get COVID.
Right.
There's a difference in the death.
Which is everyone.
Everyone.
Everyone on earth is going to get it and eventually did.
Right. There's a difference in the death rate if all, you know, 100 people get it today right. versus if 50 people get it today
right.
because of this hospital correct. Capacity question. I do wonder, I haven't followed the research on that very specific topic. I would be curious if even attempts to preserve hospital capacity work to reduce deaths, because many of the initial interventions we did, like medical interventions for people with COVID, like putting people on ventilators, didn't work and probably increased the death rate.
Right.
So you wonder. True. You wonder if you preserved the ventilator capacity,
if you,
and right. so more people were on ventilators. Did that? You know,
the idea being right. If you ended up in the hospital because of COVID, you were in you were in a bad situation anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
right.
I don't know.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a question. It's one of those questions that we don't know. And certainly Fauci has decided he's not interested in answering that question. He has his answers.
The one person I know who died of COVID, it was an elderly woman who had been my next door neighbor growing up, who took care of me when I was a kid. Wonderful woman. You know, we've been close my whole life. And she was in a nursing home in Michigan, and it was right at the beginning. And she called me, and she was very sick, and she said, they're telling me I have the thing. I didn't believe her. I was like, there's no way you have it. It was so early on. Like, you don't have the thing. Nope. Sure enough, she had it. Went into the hospital, and she went fast. It was terrible.
That's very sad.
So terrible. And she, you know, she's very old. She was in her 90s. But she was lucid and in very good health, and she could have had some years ahead of her still. I mean, she was very religious, faithful Catholic woman. She was ready for the Lord to take her, but it was a hard thing.
That's very, very sad. Hard thing. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, looking back on COVID, it's given how ineffective so many of these interventions were, there might be a temptation to minimize the fact that it was a pandemic and an awful pandemic that killed a lot of people.
Right.
But the point in bringing all of this up is that the interventions to stop this pandemic failed.
Yes.
Right. And they had their own costs and consequences. The pandemic, it's a hard thing to accept, but the pandemic was just a bad thing that happened.
Yes.
Right. It made the world a more dangerous place. And there wasn't that much that an individual could do or public or policymakers could do to make it better. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And, but they could have made it worse, and they did make it worse and plausibly caused the whole thing to start in the first place.
So. Yes. And that is what needs to continue to be investigated.
Yeah. So, you know, Fauci is never going to face criminal charges of any kinds. It would be kind of disappointing to me if the thing they get him on is contempt of Congress or something like that. It would just...
I have contempt for Congress.
Yeah, right.
That's a crime now.
You hold me in contempt. I hold you in contempt.
Yeah.
That would. So I'm
I'm not really trying to put an old man in jail. I'm trying to get to the bottom of what caused COVID and make sure we don't do it again.
And it would be nice for the public record to identify this man as a villain of sorts.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, well. Speaking of lab leaks.
Well, actually,
oh, you got more to say?
Go
for it.
We'll come back to lab leaks. Of
go
course, we will. I will say, reading through the diary. I mean, I didn't get through it's 1,000 pages, but I got through a good chunk of it, and it is just fascinating as a historical document, kind of reliving those early days and weeks and months, and seeing it from the perspective of government officials trying to deal with it. Just like it really does bring you back in time to this threat out there that then is just, it's almost reads like a horror novel. It's just getting closer and closer and the walls are closing in. And then it's just the only thing that matters. It's like, do you ever watch 28 Days Later, that movie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the female character, she has, the main female character, she has a, like, she's talking about how the rage virus is like sweeping through the country and her memories of the rage virus. And she's like, first you're seeing it on TV and then you don't have to watch the TV because it's coming through your window. Right.
Mm.
That's kind of the sense I got reading those diaries. So that was like beyond whatever you think of Fauci or the pandemic or whatever, it is just kind of a fascinating read in that respect. And the only other thing I'll say is the level of humble bragging in that diary is off the fucking charts.
Yes.
Look, we're all fallible humans.
Yeah.
We're all, you know, we participate in media.
Yeah.
You track.
I like being on TV.
You track your media appearances.
For sure.
You know, the Wall Street Journal writes a profile of you. You're going to note that in your diary.
For sure.
That's a cool thing to happen, right? But the number of anecdotes he has, Fauci, where he's like, oh, I met up with Nancy Pelosi and she said to everyone in the room that I'm the smartest person in the world. Oh, how embarrassed was that? Or how embarrassing was that? It's like, okay, come on. You know, anyone given that level of attention and acclaim, I think would be tempted towards narcissism, but some people are predisposed to it as well.
Well, yeah, and he ventures out of areas that are his expertise. Like he's trying to convince Trump to do more lockdowns because he's like, well, this is what will be politically good for you. I'm like, you don't know what's politically good for anyone. You're not a campaign specialist or a pollster.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You're just a smart guy.
Right.
Actually, I would actually his definitive statements on lab leak. That's also in a respect him stepping outside of his expertise. The whole reason he convened that call.
Because he didn't know.
Because that's, you know, he's a doctor, an infectious disease specialist, but he's not a evolutionary biologist or whatever kind of like very minute specialty.
Molecular.
He doesn't have those particular specialties that would allow him to determine that on his own. That's why he sought expert advice. And so when he goes around saying, I know the truth and I'm going to lecture you about how this is a conspiracy theory, understand that too.
Right. Yeah. And that's what allowed, again, the media was able to seize on the idea that it was a conspiracy theory because they'd had permission to do so from the researchers that Fauci initially conferred with, who were worried it was lab leak, who were pushed, according to the emails, to do proximal origins and actually land in favor of animal spillover when a month earlier they'd been all about the lab leak.
And even after the publication of that paper, some of them were still saying, I think the paper that we wrote, that I co-authored, came down too hard against Lab League.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a scandal in its own right.
Yeah.
But again, we knew a lot of that already. So, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, let's not talk about Lab Leaks. You were going to say something?
About Lab Leaks. No, we're going to do a show.
Ooh,
about
okay.
Lab Leaks. That's that fun. You just watched.
Yes, yes.
That I had been, I finished a couple weeks ago. It's been out for a Pluribus.
So good.
So good. You liked it.
Excellent. On Apple TV, if anyone hasn't seen it,
so
highly
good.
Recommend it.
It's just like, it hooks you, right? And you just like, I need to keep watching this.
Yes. Yeah, I finished it. It's 9 episodes. Each one is like an hour long, 45 yeah. minutes. But I, you know,
you
finished it over the
stop.
Course of a weekend or so. Yeah.
Like you're saying, the early episode gets the sense of the building sense of looming dread
mm-hmm.
for this. We're going to spoil it if you haven't seen it.
Spoilers.
Because we got to talk about the concept that the world, the entire world population, save for like 10 or 12 people, succumbs to this virus that causes them to all join up as a collective consciousness
yep.
that originates off-world from some signal. It's really cool how it's a signal originating off-world that instructs you how to build the virus.
Right.
And they're experimenting on it on rats, and somebody gets bitten, and then it quickly spreads because it spreads through like very fleeting saliva contact or all sorts of ways.
And the people who are infected by the virus
right, they're spreading, they want to spread it.
Are wittingly spreading it.
Right,
yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they are all part of the of one entity that but they can use the knowledge that every single person who's part of it has all the memories and expertise. So they like there's no stopping them. They can't be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But it just so happens that there's 12 people on Earth who are immune to it for now.
Right.
And they're working on fixing that. But they can't, the conceit of the show is it's kind of a benign like it can take no steps to harm these people or to harm any living thing.
It how I would describe it is it's such a great concept because there's so many different ways you could describe or conceptualize the hive mind that this virus produces, but it's almost as if every single person is converted into one giant effective altruist.
Yes.
Right? Pacifistic effective yes. altruist. Where
and paternalistic.
Yes, of course. Yeah. They are all, we're told, they tell us at least, in
yes.
a state
because they can't lie.
They're in a state of eternal bliss.
Yes.
And are incredibly pacifistic to the degree that they won't even do agriculture or farming because
right.
they don't want to harm any other living creature.
They worry that a large number of them will soon starve because they're going to run out of food because
yes.
they won't even do agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah, so there is completely pacifistic. But a consequence of this is that there's a very small number of people, 12 people in the show, who firstly, a huge amount of people died from the virus, right? 800 million.
Right, because
right?
the concept of being converted, there's like a...
it's traumatic,
if you were
yeah.
being driven in a taxi by someone who was in the midst of the conversion, that taxi's crash.
And also some people just have a like allergic reaction
or
to it
or something like that. Yeah,
right?
They suggest mm-hmm. that that's what happens to the main character's
partner,
wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, or right, if you're on a plane, the plane was going to crash. So there's... Right, so there's dead bodies everywhere for a little bit. Now, the consciousness, again, controls like... Now 5 billion people or something,
mm-hmm.
whatever survived the calamity,
like
so
seven,
is yeah. able to, like, you know, put like get them all buried or burned or whatever quickly,
mm-hmm.
or well converted into food as we
yeah.
find out because they're not
mm-hmm.
beyond consuming the remains of dead people,
right?
But yeah, but so then they come at this main character who is one of the survivors who cannot be converted in just this paternal, right, utterly paternalistic way. We'll give her anything she wants, care about her happiness to the extent that- To an absurd degree. We'll give her basically anything she wants.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other characters ends up flying around in the president's jet always because, and can have any woman he wants
mm-hmm.
or whatever, because
right.
he says, I want all these people to sleep with me and they just will.
Mm-hmm.
They care about your happiness. But because their view of the situation they're in is that, yes, this is the state of bliss, they are dedicated to converting these people to joining up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are working to find a scientific way to break whatever natural immunity they have to it, to assimilate them, even if they don't want to be assimilated.
Yep.
Because from an effective, it would be, from the effective altruism perspective, it's like, it's so great to be a part of this. letting you choose to not be a part of it is such a self-harm thing that we won't let you do.
Right.
Because we care about you this much. So it gets down to a very like libertarian versus non-libertarian values. Mm-hmm. Our main character is a fascinating and flawed human being, but who is ultimately motivated by a kind of individualist or libertarian drive
yep.
to stop this mm-hmm. and revert to A, not be converted, and to dedicate her, find any which way to reverse it, no matter how happy they say they are. They is a one entity, because it's just like wrong.
Right.
Like, and it's so obvious to her that even if they say they're happy, that it's incorrect and should be reversed for basically liberty reasons that are just obvious to her.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
She puts an inherent value on individuality,
on freedom. Choice.
Yeah. I mean, to compare
it's it to, so great.
to compare it to COVID, it is kind of remarkable where, you know, she meets up with some of the other people who hadn't been infected, and she's like, this is crazy. This is insane.
What are we doing?
And everyone else is like, oh, no, the world is so peaceful now. This is great, right? Yeah.
She's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, right.
This isn't that. Like, this is not your partner or your friends or your family. This is a hostile, alien thing mm-hmm. that we must work to defeat.
Right. It was so reminiscent of some of those arguments about lockdowns yes. where it's like, oh, who needs to go, you know, who needs to step outside their front door? You know, we're safe. You know, right. we have Netflix.
But it's an important reminder that liberty is itself to not to everyone, but to you and I and a lot of people who even people who don't self-describe as libertarians. Liberty is like an intrinsic good on its own that is worth that is a higher order importance.
To snuff it out would be a great crime.
Right. Bland happiness or something
mm-hmm.
without any liberty whatsoever is not a trade we would make.
No.
And not just because you and I are crazy ideologues, but is also not a trade normal, rational people. Like regular people would recoil against this because it's just wrong to not have liberty like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there's another character. So all of the other survivors who haven't been assimilated into the hive mind, yeah, even the ones that don't want to be assimilated into the hive mind are basically fine with it.
Right.
Because again, they're very dedicated to making you experience all this hedonistic pleasure.
Right.
Except for there's Carol, the main character who played, what's her name from Better Call Saul?
Right, the female character from Better Call Saul, who is terrific.
Yeah, Rhea Seehorn. Or,
yeah, that's her name. Yeah, mm-hmm, she's so good. She's so good.
And then there's one other guy who is even more militantly against the hive mind.
He might be one of our people. He could be a Reason magazine subscriber.
He is a Rorschach Randian type character. There's a great...
He is motivated by libertarian ideology.
100%. There is,
survivalist or...
Or a kind of a Christian vision of freedom, too.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a... he literally describes the virus as stealing people's souls.
Right.
But there's, There's a great scene in the show a couple episodes in where he's down in Paraguay, right?
Yeah.
He finds out that this character, Carol, she also is not down with the hive mind. So he is determined to go up to America to meet with her and collaborate on how to fight the plurb, the hive mind.
Yeah.
He refuses to accept help from the hive mind in any possible way.
Because they're perfectly willing to help him get to see her.
Right.
They'll do anything he wants.
That would make him happy.
Yes.
And so even if it's them hatching conspiracy to attack them, they would do that. But he has this great line where, you know, he's traveled all the way up South America. He's now in Panama. He's about to go across the Darien Gap, which is where a lot of, you know, immigrants, you know, it's a very treacherous passage.
Yeah.
And they're like, you'll die if you do this. Let us help you. And he says, everything you have is stolen.
Yes.
And he refuses to accept it.
It's so great.
It's excellent.
So great.
It
contrasts with her, right? She eventually, they start to wear her down a little bit because she forms a bond with the the person that the entity has chosen to deal with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets lonely when they withdraw the entity because she is trying to poke and prod to figure out a way to undo this, which they eventually do get annoyed with. And then they're like, we're gonna flee you.
In a very funny and passive aggressive way. We just need some space.
We need some space from you.
Right.
Because they're using language they know will bother her because mm-hmm. they're trying to unnerve her so that she'll invite them back into her life.
I have to say the actress they got to play Zosia, her chaperone, she's called, is perfect.
It's perfect.
She has the best possible face for this.
Yes.
Kind of warm but creepy and slightly condescending.
Yes.
Just that kind of that slight smile that she has all the time. So good.
She's like a tour guide in an authoritarian country type 100%, person. Yeah. Right. Showing mm-hmm. you the nice things. This is, look how nice and clean it is. Don't look at the political prisoners. and the main character, Carol Rhea Seehorn, just processes this all in such a believable way. Like, it feels like if you or I were in this situation, it would drive us crazy in all the exact same ways. And we would go through the same series of, okay, wait, you're saying you'll give me anything right now? Oh, will you give me a live grenade? They hand her a live grenade. Yeah, right. Oh, it's a live grenade. Oh my God. Like mm-hmm. it's the exact series of steps a believable person would go through. Like, you'll fly me to Las Vegas right now? All right, let's go to Las Vegas then.
It's Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. This is his show. He does this with a lot of characters. I've noticed this is a running theme. It's funny that it's set in Albuquerque too.
Yeah.
There's a this running theme in his shows where there's this character who is very difficult and frankly annoying to watch, who is also completely correct, right? So in Breaking Bad, this was Skyler White, right? You're watching Breaking Bad, and you're like, no, Walda, he's a badass, you know? Let's just get off his back, you know? Eventually, towards the end of the show, you're like, okay, no, you know, he's a monster. But it's like, get off his back. He's trying to, you know, set up you and the children for, you know, when he's gone.
Right.
Why are you, you know, throwing a wrench in the gears? Rhea Seehorn's character in Better Call Saul is similar. Yeah. And Carol, who she plays in Pluribus, I couldn't help but like cringe and feel bad for the hive minds and their interactions because she is such a bitch to these people who are doing nothing but like trying to satisfy all her desires.
But are evil and want to sublimate her.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So she's completely correct.
Yes.
But even so, just like me being like non-confrontational, I'm just like, oh, no, well, why are you being so mean to them? These people that enslaved the human race and killed your partner.
Vince Gilligan is a genius. He's such
truly,
a genius.
Truly.
The way he stages things. I love that he uses the desert as his settings because the desert matches his style of storytelling where there's no extraneous dialogue or there's just no extraneous things. Mm-hmm. Everything he shows you is relevant to what's happening and if the shot opens with a dragonfly flapping its wings, later there will be a moment where you go, oh, the dragonfly. And it feels so good. There's nothing is shown to you that doesn't have some relevance. Because nothing survives in the desert that is extraneous. It's a harsh place, right? Mm. It's a sparse place. Mm. He's a sparse storyteller.
Yeah.
And it's brutally efficient.
It also does this thing that he did on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul too, which I really like, where it starts with a scene that is, you're completely—
incomprehensible.
Yeah, you're completely mystified by.
Like a vignette.
You have no idea. And then through the course of the episode, it comes to make sense, right? But it just starts, it hooks you because it's like, what is going on? Right. What is this mystery?
My favorite one of that in Breaking Bad is in the Madrigal, the parent company of the chicken and the episode, the place where the Gus worked after, and this is after he's killed.
The parent company of the meth lab.
Right. and they're taste testing fried chicken sauces in this German factory, and the guy doing it is preparing to commit suicide because he knows the DEA is going to burst down the door, and he's just like rotely eating the mismatch between this man who's about to kill himself and the taste tester person describing the flavors and how excited they are about breakthroughs in the flavor mm-hmm. is just so, in this German warehouse that you've never seen before. It's so
right that
great.
Has never been introduced before. You
know, yeah. And it's just going so great. Mm-hmm. It's so great.
Yeah. Okay. Let me throw a controversial interpretation of the hive mind at you.
Okay.
Which I don't completely buy, but I think because again, it's such a rich concept that there's kind of this element too. The hive mind is capitalism, the market.
What?
Let me explain. Let me explain. Yeah.
Socialism.
It is socialism, but it's also capitalism. What? How can that be? Let me tell you. Okay. So I've been watching the show over the weekend, right? And yeah, I was just in like I was in a shitty mood for no reason on like Sunday afternoon, right? Just like for no reason at all. I was just like feeling like negative. And I was sitting there drinking an athletic beer, non-alcoholic beer. And they've gotten really good, right? Taste almost.
So I'm told.
Yeah. right. Well, you're a non-alcoholic.
I'm not a beer drinker.
You're a non-alcoholic wine guy. But yeah. but they've gotten really good. Like non-alcoholic beer used to be really bad, like famously so, because they used to, they would make normal beer and they would boil all the alcohol off. So it was just like really, you know, just like the, basically just like the leftover residue was what was it filled the beer. Whereas like now they've changed the process. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's really good. So it's like sitting there being in a bad mood and I like look at the can and it's like, you know, brewed with this for extra crispness. I'm like, these people who have, people who I don't know at all have put a huge amount of effort into making this can in my hand, this drink, like really good. For nothing, I haven't done anything for them. Mm-hmm.
They've
just
the beer.
Yeah, they have produced this great product to make me just a little happier, right? And it made me all this effort and time and production that went into this. And that's kind of how the hive mind treats Carol, right? They're like, you're a huge bitch to us, but we're going to spend a lot of, we're going to do everything we can. We're going to move heaven and earth, summon all the resources of the globe just to try to make you smile a little bit. Even though you're plotting to destroy us, well, how about some eggs, you know?
yeah. They put her, right, they don't need grocery stores, so they get rid of it. And then she's like, I want to go shopping at my grocery store, even though they could just deliver anything she needs. Mm-hmm. So then they restock all of her groceries they're not ever going to use because they don't believe in.
Right. And in fact, they're costing themselves because they're all eventually going to starve to death, right? Or most of them will.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they want to build, but it's like a von Neumann thing. Like they want to spread it, right? They're obsessed with, they're going to build a satellite so they can send the signal to any other planets that might be out there.
Yeah. Which
it's a sinister.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of a science fiction trope, but yeah, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, whatever. They describe it as a biological imperative, which is so cool given that it is a virus, right? And what is a virus? I mean, actual virus is not wittingly, but you know, their evolutionary logic is to spread and evolve in whatever way allows them to spread as quickly as they can, as it can.
All right. Well, speaking of kind of libertarian ideology type things, I noticed something I wanted to call attention to because she's sitting right behind us, Ayn Rand.
Her stern expression,
our disapproving expression. Our guiding light. She was misrepresented rather badly by J.D. Vance in his book, apparently. I haven't read the book, but I saw people drew my attention to this. It got tweeted. Where is it? Oh, I've opened every tweet but this one. Where did it go? Oh, I had it open. Gosh darn it. You go into Slack, dig it out. There it is. Okay. Alex Norasta tweeted it. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the quote from the book. This is from J.D. Vance's book. Atlas Shrugged foreshadowed the dominant sentiment of the educated class into which I had been invited. The feeling that people got what they deserved to get. By working hard, elite college achievers earned their social prestige and superior job prospects. Any sense of community attachment that we owe something to the people from whom we came gave way to the one-upmanship of modern meritocracy. That's like not a... feel like people get what they deserve to get by going to like the educated class? No. Like, Rand doesn't care about the educated class. She cares about people who are providing value to others.
Yeah, who are independent and seeing themselves in inherent worth.
Or who will buck the trend. But I guess he just, all he cares about is, or so purports to care about is community ties, owing something to others. And it is true, her philosophy is very much opposed to the idea that you owe something to others.
Right.
But your your worth in success is not tied to some being part of a credentialed elite.
No, and in fact,
it is providing something for others.
And in fact, the Fountainhead, you know, the not her first novel, but of the two big ones, her first, has this whole concept of the second-hander, right? Someone who values success and advancement because of how they appear. They value what other people value. Right. And so that's why they're striving and trying to, you know, get status for themselves. And yeah, in the Fountainhead, Rand contrasts one character who's doing all these schemey things to become a renowned architect, even though he really sucks at it, versus Howard Rourke, who is willing to go work in a quarry and be tossed out of the profession because he's not willing to compromise his vision. So, yeah, I think that's. People conflate often, you know, Rand's vision of being true to your own values and, you know, your own abilities with just simple advancement, which is what I would associate with higher education and those kind of status games. So,
right. Oh, and the idea that Atlas Shrugged has swept higher education and become the Bible of affluent professionals is just totally nonsense because
they would explicitly progressives hold. Yeah. Reject
Rand in contempt.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this is part of the new right, national conservatives, whatever you want to call them. They can't stop telling the story of libertarians being in charge. For, you know, they're fighting against the libertarian dominance
feel
of the country.
In charge?
I don't, because I'm a libertarian.
Bane, reset the clock.
Right.
We got our Bane.
I'm sure he'd say Bane is a Randian hero as well.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. No, see, the reason they make these arguments
Bane, an
isn't
explicitly
because...
Leninist figure, but...
Yeah, the reason they make these arguments, J.D. Vance particularly makes these kinds of arguments, isn't because they're accurate. It's because... It's not because... Ayn Rand has been running the country or Rand acolytes have been running the country. It's because he's trying to turf those people out of the conservative movement, right?
Yeah.
That's why he makes those arguments. So it has nothing to do with libertarians running the country or whatever else. It's that libertarians used to have more status and influence in conservative circles, and he's rebelling against that. And so that's why he has to say this idiocy.
He's getting himself in trouble with some other people on the right lately.
Rod Dreher, yeah.
Rod Dreher said he begged... J.D. Vance to be more explicitly rejecting of the Groypers or whatever, and he wouldn't do it, and now they're not friends anymore. Ben Shapiro's been complaining about his economic policies and his foreign policies, and now none of that will matter one iota, I predict, and he will just easily be the next nominee.
You think he will easily be the next nominee?
I think so, yeah. And then they'll all get behind him. He's not the first choice of a lot of people on the right. I think they wish someone else would go forward and get it, but I just don't think you can get past he's the sitting vice president. He's a young guy. Like, what, somebody's going to successfully challenge him for it? I don't think so.
No, I think...
It's just going
to
be his
turn. If someone was going to successfully challenge him in a primary, it would be because the Trump administration was very unpopular and conservatives and the right more generally wanted to move beyond him. But we know...
Within Republican primary voters...
We know
Trump
that's not going to happen.
Not be more popular.
Because we already ran this experiment,
yes.
Right? This was the 2024 primary.
Yes.
Trump was at a low ebb. A lot of people were kind of done with this guy. And it turned out you had some...
Right. A lot of people
qualified.
In elite conservative media were done with him.
Yeah.
It turned out Republican primary voters wanted another helping please.
Mm-hmm.
Sign me up.
Yep.
That's what they said.
See, the only way that wouldn't necessarily track to a 2028 primary
is that it's Vance, not Trump.
Yeah. Right? So maybe the fact that he doesn't have that hold over Trump's base well of, you know, supporters would then give people, you know, people would look around enough at other candidates that maybe then it would be a bit more.
I mean, if Trump
contest.
Calls for there to be other candidates or rejects Vance or does something of that, then yeah, he'll be totally screwed. I don't really see Trump
he's
doing
smart.
That.
He's smart enough to just keep being a lickspittle while giving himself enough plausible deniability about things that I think he thinks his supporters care enough about. Like, I mean, the Iran war is, I think, a great example, right? You know, it starts and then there's like some of these leaks in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, wherever, about, oh, you know, Vance really didn't like this decision, whatever else. But he's not going out there and criticizing Trump, right? he is just having surrogates leak that this wasn't his idea. So when this becomes a primary issue, he can say, hey, look, you know, it wasn't my idea, you know, but I, you know, Trump wanted to do this and I faithfully tried to execute that vision. So
I've started to notice that every issue just must eventually become partisan. Every issue, if it doesn't have a clear partisan valence, just you've got to give it time.
Yeah.
And right now, yeah, like non-intervention and this, right, there's this increasing skepticism of Israel on both sides of the political spectrum. But I'm not sure that will always be the case. I think eventually the people who are skeptical of interventionism and Iran will have to find a home in one party or the other.
Yep.
And it seems to me that's going to be the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party that they find a home in. Mm-hmm. Right? And now it's not that way right now, but like you're already seeing this a little bit with like commentators on the right who spend a lot of time criticizing Israel and criticizing the foreign policy, like Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson are over time, and Megyn Kelly are over time becoming a bit more estranged from the Republican Party mm-hmm. and from, now they still have huge audiences. I'm not saying like they're pursuing unpopular ideas. They're at the apex of their influence and popularity more broadly. But like, and they get a lot of strange new respect, appreciation from progressive people, et cetera. But they are stepping a little bit outside the bounds mm-hmm. of the Republican coalition. And that to me is a sign of it becoming, like it will eventually adopt the partisan valence, right?
Yeah.
Where it will happen on the other side, right? Where very pro-Israel Jewish people, John Fetterman, I'll make my prediction now, will be a Republican before the next time he faces election.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And people who very much care about Israel, and again, this is not to say they're right or that, like, I'm just observing the phenomenon take place.
You're just noticing things.
I'm just noticing. They will be more likely to find a home in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
That totally. Is what I predict.
You know, it's...
Could be wrong. Been wrong before. That's what I see happening.
It's interesting, you know, media is so much more decentralized and independent mm-hmm. now. And the naive assumption would be that this would actually break down these kind of partisan valences, mm-hmm. The two-party system. But what it actually does is it allows the two parties to equilibrate around
yes.
these particular positions a lot easier.
Because you have better analytics about who thinks what.
Yeah. And also, you know, if you're a pundit who is, you know, you're conservative and you really don't like Israel, right? Back in the day, your options for work are still the Wall Street Journal and Fox News,
yeah.
right? So you're going to stick around being a Republican, even if you're going to have pretty serious right. debates within the party. But now you can go off and do your own thing, and that's easier for you than to find yourself yeah. in the other coalition.
Yeah. You'll just say how you really feel.
And that's why even though issues, you know, parties change their positions, you have a lot less diversity within parties mm-hmm. Now than you used to, right?
Right. It's much neater, mm-hmm. right? What Republicans believe is much more, this is what Republicans
homogenous,
believe.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what Democrats, right. Because that allows them to function at a high level of competitiveness.
Yep.
Right. That's why we've had a bunch of elections in a row now where it's pretty close. Comes down to a small number of voters in a few states that are, for reasons of happenstance, closely divided, but it's close. We don't have the 49 state blowout. Will never happen again, because if there's a 49 state blowout, that means one party did something really wrong.
Yeah,
they really screwed up. You wouldn't, if you play a board game, you know, with somebody, one of those complicated board games I like, you get better at it over time, mm-hmm. and the score between the two people gets closer. You don't blow the person out when they both know what they're doing. That's how the political they're playing a game over and over again, and they're pretty good at. Getting it 50-50.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like in you know, Econ 101,
yeah,
in a perfectly
sure.
competitive market, the assumption is basically all profit is economic profit, at least. You know, people are going to still make a little bit of money, but like all economic profit is ground into dust.
Yeah.
And the market price is basically just, you know,
right.
the cost of replacement or whatever.
Plus a penny to make the profit for the
exactly,
person.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. And the parties are kind of in a perfectly competitive situation yep. in a way where it's like everyone is just scrambling for 50 plus one.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what's going to happen.
Okay, actually, if I can, just to bring it back to Pluribus real quick, since you brought up board games.
Sure.
There's a scene in the show where she's like, I don't know what to talk about with her chaperone. And she's like, oh, why don't we play a board game? And she's like going through the board games, trying to figure out which one would possibly be fun when she's playing against the sum of all human knowledge.
Right.
What board game do you think would actually be fun to play against the hive mind? Would there be anyone?
Man. Well, you'd have to rule out games like chess because you're playing against a chess grandmaster.
Right.
Because the collective has the knowledge of everyone it assimilated. Mm-hmm. And among that will be people who are just chess grandmasters.
Yep.
So you can't beat it at that. Same goes for Scrabble.
Right. They would know every single word and know the exact...
Like, well-known game. Right. Every word would be known. So it'd have to be something... I mean, I was going to say you could do pretty well maybe with some of those games that I play that are not so wide that, I mean, but they have a hardcore fan community. So you're still going to get, I would say Dominion is this card game I play. But what the creator of Dominion, Donald X. Vaccarino, what if he'd been, he's a better player than I am. He created the game. Mm-hmm. Man, this is a hard one. Do you have an answer?
So at first I thought, oh, maybe it would be poker. Because there's, you know, obviously there's a math element to it, a probability element to it, but then there's also just kind of, a little bit of social deduction skill. But the problem is you need at least four people to play poker. And
well, and you're playing against...
You'd be playing against
the greatest poker player who
ever
lived.
Well, so you'd be
playing
against the greatest poker player ever, but also if you assemble people for a poker game, they would all know what everyone else has.
Right.
And so that wouldn't be fun, right? So you can't do that. I think it would just be games of chance. Like Monopoly, maybe, I think would be the closest.
Two-person Monopoly is not really even, it's just rolling
dice. Or Risk.
Risk is just rolling dice.
No, but you could get...
Oh, the computer.
Well, or you could get other hive mind people to play with you. And I mean, ultimately the competitiveness would completely come down to the dice rolls because they would be able to make every perfectly... logical strategic decision.
Yeah.
But no, I think it would kind of, this is why freedom is important, right?
Yeah.
We like a little bit of chance and a little bit of, struggle, but competitiveness.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't be any competitiveness.
I mean, it's interesting which games, like for instance, the computer is just better. Like my understanding now of chess is that the best computer is just the best.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe the chess grandmaster human is they're not even competitive with the computer, right?
I don't think so.
They can maybe win every now and then, but mostly the computer just... My understanding, frankly, with professional chess is that even when the two best humans face each other, it's like always a draw unless someone might do something that's just like that's almost suboptimal to force a condition where maybe one or the other is going to win.
Mm-hmm.
But... It's mostly just a draw,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so then like you could do a little bit of a mind game where you do what looks like a mistake in order to provoke your opponent into making a mistake. But
so like that's not the case, for instance, with like Dominion, this card game I play,
mm-hmm.
right? I can beat but maybe if they designed a better computer, maybe that's coming to an end because of AI. But I'm better than the computer every time.
What
the computer is not competitive.
Yeah. Since we're on this track, what would you do in the Plurb environment? Like
I'm with her. Fight it.
Well,
you're fighting it.
But day to day, you still gotta, you gotta do something. So like, would you be the guy who flies around in Air Force One and play acts James Bond scenes or? Because like she's a writer, right, in the show,
right?
But like that would seem so empty to me because your audience is just. A weird hive mind that's going to tell you everything you do is
I mean,
great.
I think I would feel bad taking advantage of the people for, like...
Yeah,
the one character enjoys, like... Yeah, he goes to Vegas and he gambles with the hive mind and wins and feels good. Like, that would not have any value to... And he instructs them to play act like he's this really impressive spy or something. Like, he's James Bond and he's going to win... At the casino, and like that would not be, I would not do that. Like that would not satisfy me at all, knowing that these people are all actors.
Yeah, and even like the hedonism you could indulge in, you're dealing with people who can't say no to you, and
right.
So it's like you would just be like a slave master.
Right.
That seems disgusting as well.
Right.
The only thing I can think of is it would be a good opportunity to be like a historian, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they have the hive mind of every living person, right? All these memories.
Right, you'd ask them a lot of questions.
Yeah, you could get to the bottom of like 9/11 or something, you know, the lab leak, whatever else. So that's something that, like, you know, that's you're writing for maybe future humans who aren't part of the hive mind, but that's the only thing I could think of. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail us.
No, that's a good question. Plug. We were gonna, what was the fun one you wanted to do? We're having fun. Who killed us? That was a great idea. I wanted to do that one. It was a good idea.
Yeah.
If you were killed, who would you want the conspiracy to be that killed you? That's what you came up with,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so I actually know exactly what it would be.
So Christian's killed, mm-hmm. and there's rumors online pinning it on me?
No, because I don't think you'd feel too much guilt or remorse.
Oh, certainly not. Certainly not.
No, I know this because I remember once I was walking to work here in D.C., and
always a dangerous thing to do.
Indeed. It's actually
in
relevant.
In these streets.
It's relevant. I was walking to work, and who do I see driving to work but Max Boot, who is a very hawkish, I think he still is, columnist at the Washington Post.
Is he still
right?
there? I'm not sure he is.
He's one of these guys that got us into Iraq, right? Yeah. And he was, you know, he was...
And then caught TDS and...
Now, yeah, right. Yeah, now is one of the liberals with strange new respect, right? But he was, you know, turning through the crosswalk as I was waiting for it. And I just had this moment where I was like, what if I just threw myself in front of the car? And so then Max Boot would have to deal with having run me over, right? Yeah. And so that's what
Another
I would like, you know.
Body on his conscience.
Yeah, one of many, yeah. One of these Bill Kristol types, you know. Oh. People fingered the hawks. You know, I was a brave voice against the war.
I see.
And they killed me for it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know who's going to try to silence me. It would be like, well, now that I become so much more outspoken on Ukraine, it would probably be Russia would be out
to
get me.
Would you want a Russiagate fervor over your death?
No, I don't want to contribute to that. I think I would like to be rumored to have been killed by some like serial killer. So like the DC strangler or whatever. Oh, that we don't know what happened, but there's a lot of signs that point
to... Yeah, you're a murder mystery guy. You would want your death to be part of this.
A murder mystery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That would be cool.
Okay.
That would be cool. You know, we'll never know for sure. We'll never solve it, but, you know, that kind of thing.
You got it, buddy.
Thank you. But I don't intend to ever die.
So, that's good. Yeah.
Let's say a few words about Ross Douthat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Who is leaving the New York Times for 17 years. This is well-known conservative columnist at the New York Times. And unlike many of the columnists they've employed, you know, they like the kind of David French, Bret Stephens, Brooks, kind of never Trump neoconservative, Max Boot type person we were describing, which the critics of that say, well, that is actually not a very, a perspective that has a significant following, especially if it's totally hostile to Trump.
Yeah.
Now, Ross Douthat is not in that mold.
No.
He is still critical of Trump.
He's
on
not a
like,
Trump partisan.
No, he finds the corruption and the election denial bad. Yeah. I don't think the Times would ever employ someone who is going to defend election denial.
Mm-hmm.
But he understands the undercurrents of Trumpism very well. He writes about them very authoritatively, and he has helped, you know, chronicle without derision, but in a way that just explains what's going on. And, and he's a great writer. And so he's a loss to the Times. He's going to 60 Minutes, Barry Weiss. He's going to be part of 60 Minutes in CBS, which... he'll probably be great at too, but I will
he's
great at everything. I will certainly miss his columns, though. They're a cut above the rest.
They truly are.
They're just some of the best writing.
He's very smart and very analytical. And it's just, I don't know, he's able to entertain and take seriously crazy ideas or just any idea while still keeping a certain critical distance, which is very difficult for a columnist. The problem with the Times, like, kept conservative columnists, like, you know, he offered one criticism, which is this isn't actually very representative of conservatives, which is fair. But the problem I have with it is, you know, cause New York, it's, you know, it's a elite paper. It doesn't have to be representative per se. The problem I have with it is that they hire people who have, you know, some conservative bona fides, but then are just so very against, you know, in a partisan valence against the current Republican Party of the time, that all they do is spend their time arguing inside the tent against other conservatives. I mean, David French is an excellent example of this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's still anti-abortion and pro-war and everything else, right? But basically all his columns are just like complaining about other conservatives. And it's like, if you're the conservative, bitch about the liberals a little. You know what I mean? I think that would be more interesting. And Ross Douthat can do that, but a lot of the other ones don't.
I think the New York Times is a perfect, outstanding organization. I have no criticisms
of
them.
Okay.
Eric Nelson, who's a editor of conservative books at a mainstream publisher, had a list of recommendations for potential replacements. I'll just read them just for fun. Richard Hanania, Sohrab Ahmari, Wilfred Riley, Noah Rothman, Jason Chaffetz, Eli Lake, Charles C.W. Cook. These are some good suggestions. Robbie Suave, Amy Chua, or Rob Henderson. Huh?
What was that last one you said?
Very interesting list. So anyway, the Times is a perfect organization, outstanding place. It'd be a wonderful place to work at.
It would be great.
And I have no criticisms.
It would be great to have a full-on actual libertarian columnist of the Times. Or if they hired you, that would be good too. But
yeah.
What can you do?
So we'll miss him. I'll miss reading him, but hopefully he still does at 60 Minutes. I mean, so he does a podcast as well at the New York Times, which is also pretty good.
It's very good.
I assume he's doing, but you know, 60 Minutes is TV, so it's a little bit more of a confining format.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think it is a loss to the viewers and the readers. I assume they just gave him gobs of money to do it, but I don't know.
Yeah, we'll do a lot of things for gobs of money.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. We got anything else today? What else did I write?
Was there
down
any other
here?
Big?
No.
What's going on in politics?
Who cares? I did a event with the Bitcoin Policy Institute people this week. It was kind of interesting.
About what?
About
Bitcoin.
About data centers, one of your favorite subjects.
Okay.
And the extent to which the opposition to it is astroturfed by hostile foreign adversaries, namely China, I think you've been a little skeptical of that. I will say that, so I talked to Sam Lyman, the author of this report, who works for the Bitcoin Policy Institute, and his claims were pretty reasonable and grounded in fact. It was not like sensationalist. It was not, he said repeatedly, I am not claiming or pretending that everyone opposed to data centers has just been duped by Chinese propaganda or is just, you know, he clarified that over and over and over again. But he did point to a number of projects that have been halted by community members, you know, going to their city council demanding a halt to this, that were deliberately targeted by the Party for Socialism and Liberation, which, you know, identifies that a project is going to happen, goes there, door knocks, convinces residents that they should be up in arms about this. And this group, which is a, you know, explicitly Marxist communist group, is connected, if not via explicitly via funding, which they don't know for sure, but is connected in that it's like founders overlap with
what's the guy's name? Singham?
Who is clearly a pro-Chinese.
Lives in China.
Yeah. Wants to help China win.
Yeah, likely gets CCP funding for his various far-left ventures.
And he is involved with them and this group that has targeted data center projects and like had the brakes have been slammed on many of them.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. I didn't know this Singham fellow, I had not ever heard about until recently.
He's a notorious character.
Yeah.
I guess my pushback with any sort of claims of astroturfing isn't that there are vested interests, special interests, and in this case, maybe, you know, nefarious foreign interests behind a particular viewpoint or behind a particular set of activists. It's that if it resonates with people and gets some sort of popular fervor, it's because people are primed to believe that or already do, right? Like it's not hard to get people to come out against development,
right?
It's not hard to get people to come out against development of big boxy warehouses that they're worried is going to cause the robots
to. But the fact that it's so easy to do it almost make like you should just not do that. You shouldn't provoke and scare people about something that might be a little bit annoying or inconvenient for them while the construction's going on. You know, construction's always annoying. Right now, the around us in the building we're filming this podcast from, there's been ceaseless construction for the last several weeks. It's like harder to get into the building. Yeah. It's annoying, but whatever. It probably has to happen. Fine. Like, it's kind of bad to scare people about that and work them up about it when it's just kind of a fact of life that should happen. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, so it's bad. It's bad regardless of its necessary impact. But yeah, like so, PSL, these guys, they're a mainstay at any sort of DC protest. They're all, you know, if there's any sort of anti-war protests, they often organize them too. They're there, you know, saying, you know, the only war is class war and all this kind of stuff. Like, they're bad and shady characters, but again, it's like the anti-war protests, they don't do anything, right?
Yeah, no.
But this does stuff, but it's because people don't need another
reason.
City
council, when it confronts all these angry people, they vote it down. 7-0. Never mind.
Yeah.
Never mind. We're done.
But they would. They're doing that in context where there's no communist string pulling. I wrote about this case in Nashville, where they're trying to build a data center in an industrial park that already has a data center next to the zoo, and the zoo is very worried that the vibrations from the data center will negatively affect the clouded leopards that they breed there. And so this, you know, but the okay, you know, noise
maybe?
Pollution. That's
I don't
yeah,
know.
Sure,
could be.
Maybe. I interviewed a zookeeper who said it's kind of an open question, but I asked the zookeeper, are we not all animals in a cage in a way? And she said yes. But regardless, what's funny about that case is
I feel like zookeeper would be your type in woman a little bit. I feel like you could date a zookeeper. A lady zookeeper.
Yeah, I haven't really met too many.
No.
But I mean, if we have any zookeeper listeners, feel free to reach out. You know where to find me. At the zoo. I do love going to the zoo.
Zoos are great. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go find Mrs. Brishy at the zoo.
Yeah, right. Okay. Regardless. What's funny though is the property that they're trying to build a data center on, it's already zoned for being a data center, so the city can't do any regulatory things to stop them. So what they're doing instead is they're eminent domaining the land. They're going to spend like $40 million to buy the land to stop this data center project.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Which is funny because it's like, why don't you just take a fraction of that money and put
just
some padding? Yeah, put some padding on the leopard
cage. Put some earmuffs on the leopards. They can look like, you could do, do leopards have stripes or spots? The leopards
spots.
Have spots.
Yeah.
So you put some spots on the earmuffs and our leopard can't change his stripes. Well, he now can because they got stripes on him or whatever it is. You know that expression.
And
you know all the expressions because you're always hanging out at zoos hitting on women and it's getting a little,
I bring my book of idioms that I read to them.
They're getting a little tired of it.
Yeah. I actually do teach dogs new tricks every day. Thank you very much.
Oh, an elephant never forgets, but they wish they could. Oh my God.
Oh boy.
All right. Well, let's just wrap it up.
That's enough silliness.
That's enough silliness.
I got to get back to the zoo.
This has been a fun one. Been a pleasure. Pluribus. Great show.
Great show.
Hope you guys have watched it and sat through our long discussion.
You got enough time for next week, so.
And I'm going to try to watch that Widow's Bay show at some
Widow's
point.
Bay discussion is coming. So.
It's coming. Maybe not next week, but soon.
Very good.
All right. See you guys later. Bye-bye.